So I'd like to introduce Jamie Huebner, and he is speaking on pollution and property rights, a Christian libertarian perspective. Dr. Huebner is the Director of Institutional Effectiveness, the founding chair of Christian Studies, and part-time professor of economics at John Witherspoon College in Rapid City, South Dakota. Thanks.
Okay. Get this to work here. Everybody hear me? A few years ago at the International, this was the international meeting, American Scientific Affiliation conference in Ontario, I gave a lecture on the topic of emergence and complexity. The purpose was to outline how complex systems can emerge from the application of simple laws acting in lower levels. Let's see, do I hit space bar to go over?
No, the down arrow.
Down arrow. Try this again. It's showing there, but not up there.
Well, that's interesting. We haven't had that variety yet today.
Actually, I'm not sure it's...
Maybe oh, hit that button. Let's go on slideshow. No, it's picking. It's deciding to do an object. Let's not do an object.
Oh, there we go.
We're working.
Back to...
Okay.
All right.
So okay, I'll have to speak a little fast now. Lost a minute.
You're the last guy.
Okay, so... our Earth, solar system, and stars, for example, are the result of simple laws of attraction and repulsion. Or consider how thousands of individual locusts avoiding contact and staying close together can produce a swarm that destroys acres of land in just hours. And yet there's no leader, there's no central planning, there's no elections, there's no committees, there's no coercion, there's no looking ahead in time. The same goes for the complex systems of roads created unconsciously by cattle going from pasture to water sources and thousands of other things. This power of decentralization is being taken advantage of through things like the internet, Wikipedia, and blockchain technology. So we say things like the swarm knows what it's doing and create metaphors like the invisible hand. All of this concerns emergence, swarm intelligence, and herd mentality. Well, as it turns out, not only do simple laws give rise to complex systems, but these systems are extremely efficient and exhibit mutual benefits. It just so happens that bees' desire for food also pollinates plants, and these plants also happen to produce food. That happens to be visible, edible, accessible, durable, and nutritious for a whole different set of creatures. And when I eat all of this, it's not only nutritious, but enjoyable as well. The psalmist in Psalm 104 meditates on these kind of things. The same kind of phenomena in various parts of nature, from the pattern designs of slime molds to the coordinated work of ants, applies to our own species. Human beings are particularly economic creatures. Private property and the concept of what is mine and yours is known intuitively at an extremely young age. And from this simple platform of ownership and voluntary exchange, all the complexities and renowned wealth of the free market systems all over the world arise. As Michael Rothschild put it in his 1990 book, Bionomics, capitalism or free markets is a phenomena of nature, not some modern invention. We're reminded of this every time command economies discover yet another illegal underground network of buyers and sellers, where thousands of people are risking their lives just to barter for food and water. We're also reminded of this every time a business goes under and another succeeds. Natural selection continues its work. But there's a rising concern that this freedom and respect for property is fundamentally deficient. The popular narrative today is that enforcing property rights and contract law isn't sufficient to prevent adverse macro-level states of affairs, like overfishing, forest destruction, and for our purposes, pollution. Left to themselves, free individuals won't protect or produce environmental goods. What is needed is central planning, leadership committees, coordination, and above all, coercion. Only global organizations and regulatory agencies can make accurate forecasts of the future, make wise, selfless, apolitical decisions on behalf of the whole, and wield the right amount of force at all the right places at just the right times, all of which will optimally serve the common good and save the world. Without environmental regulation, everyone in Europe, Canada, and the U.S. would still be swimming in the filth of the Industrial Revolution. I want to challenge this popular dogma because it's largely false, not to mention shamelessly pro-tyranny. As it turns out, enforcing property rights, like English common law, is not only the most effective way of protecting human freedom and increasing wealth, but is also the most effective way of protecting the environment. So the basic idea behind this so-called libertarian perspective is that people are free to do whatever they want with themselves and their property so long as they don't infringe on the rights of others. It's simply wrong to initiate force or fraud against a person and or their property. This idea is as ancient as civilization itself, but was particularly expressed in Judaism, Christianity, and Western civilization as a whole. This arrangement of property rights and contract law served as the operating system upon which our society is built. In this framework, pollution is just one way of violating property rights. It commits either trespass or nuisance. A trespass is an invasion, whether there's harm or not. If I throw a cardboard box on your lawn, I've trespassed whether there's any damage or not. A nuisance, on the other hand, is when a person's right to the enjoyment of their property is infringed. If a corporation builds a factory that spews soot on other people's yards, this is a nuisance that could be easily solved in court through an injunction and/or damages. This is precisely what happened, in fact. And not just for soot, but for countless other contaminants of air, water, and land, such as steam, chemicals, fumes, dust, smoke, tar, slime, etc. And not just for 1 or 2 years, and not just for a few isolated incidents, but for hundreds of court cases for over 500 years in Europe, and then nearly 200 years in Canada and the United States. One of the first cases of air pollution was addressed in 1611, the same year the King James Bible was first published. This common law, as it came to be known, saved countless rivers, streams, forests, homes, fields, animal species, natural resources, and otherwise. It wasn't until modernity that this arrangement was considered deficient. And even then, it wasn't because it didn't protect the environment, it's because it protected the environment too much. One complaint by a resident, one alteration in the quality of water, was enough to shut down an entire development project or factory operation. This again happened in a number of court cases throughout the 15th to the 19th centuries, and we've been coasting on that environmental progress ever since. Now, of course, there were gaps in the success. In the 1800s, Toronto's harbors and Great Britain's streams were filthy. But contrary to popular belief, this wasn't because the law system was deficient. It was for a number of other reasons. For starters, ownership was lacking. Lakes and rivers, just like the ocean, will be polluted so long as it's public instead of private. This is called the tragedy of the commons. It's one of the most widely acknowledged economic phenomena. We'll talk about this if we've got time later. The fastest way of protecting the environment is to find a way of establishing ownership. Second, few people actually knew their rights and knew the law. The same is true today. You hear this phrase, know your rights, know the law. That's because people don't. Third, pollution wasn't viewed the same back then as it was for us today. Cholera, for example, was routinely blamed on drunkards, dirty houses, humid air, or my favorite, intemperance. Fourth, pollution was viewed as a necessary cost for economic progress. The ends justifies the means, so why bother complaining? And fifth, people were very desperate for work and didn't want to complain about terrible working conditions. They didn't want to compromise their position. Sixth, litigation was often very expensive and sometimes complicated. You can see then that it's important to consider these factors before pointing the finger at common law and the courts for being deficient in protecting the environment. There's a lot more going on. So what has happened since then? Why are we now pursuing regulation instead of litigation like it used to be for so many centuries? In a word, the crony capitalists, the wealthy industrialists of the 20th century gained the upper hand, and so the polluters, in other words, bought out the government in order to overrule the courts, which then allowed them to commit mass pollution, enough pollution necessary for their business. How? How did this occur? Well, through environmental regulation. Yes, you heard it right. Environmental regulation was created to protect pollution and protect polluters. It's actually remained that way in a lot of sectors ever since. Like so much of political propaganda, the language is designed to confound. In any case, the result is that the concern for the public good now trumped the individual's property rights. This happened through a series of court cases in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Major cases demonstrating this include the Lands and Railways Clauses Consolidation Act of 1845, Hull versus Barlow, 1858. There's a list of, I'm not going to read them all, but there's a list of seminal cases here. The environmental destruction following these cases, not to mention the lack of any justice for those whose properties and businesses were destroyed, was almost immediate. And by the time of World War II, the philosophy of collectivism was in full swing. Centralization projects were incarnated in central banking, the New Deal, and of course, a host of socialist experiments in command economies around the world. The shift away from property rights was part of this larger movement, and its impact cannot be overstated. The traditional view can be summarized by the great Sir William Blackstone in the 1700s. He says, "So great is the regard for the law for private property that it will not authorize the least violation of it. No, not even for the general good of the whole community." So, for example, in 1858, in the Attorney General versus Borough of Birmingham, a public sewer poured waste into a river so that it killed fish, created disease, and prevented cattle from drinking water. The city said, the polluter, quote, "private interests must bend to those of the country at large." The judge ruled this as a remarkable novelty, unquote, and shot it down. And the court's ruling protected this natural resource, as we would expect like other cases of its time. But now with the shift to this so-called advanced modernity, the state, whether in the form of parliament or Congress or a king, took on new powers so that the private interests could and should, it was argued, be subjugated to serve the common good, or this interesting word, society. It's not clear what these terms always mean. Isn't society and the public good just the aggregate of private individuals and groups? It's a good question. Anyway, the word society and public good basically came to mean, well, whatever government officials decide at any convenient moment. That's what the public good is, just like it is today. Ironically, in the same year, one court ruled in the complete opposite direction, 1858, where, quote, "private convenience must yield to public necessity." This was upheld. This case and others that followed then opened the door to systematic pollution of property and began to erode the legal and economic foundations of the developing world. So how can we summarize the superiority of common law and property rights, 5 minutes, okay, over modern regulation and protection of the environment? Well, I want to look at four areas, and I don't have time to elaborate on all of them. But the first is simple and efficient design. It's conceptually simple. It can be summarized in a single sentence. Like, don't commit violence, some put it. In fact, Blackstone in 1768 compared it to the Golden Rule, and I don't have to read that quote. But it's also intuitive. As I stated earlier, the concept of what is mine and the rules of exchange hardly need to be taught. Two-year-olds understand this. Human beings are economic creatures given dominion over the earth and enjoy transforming creation into something more useful or beautiful. This individual and communal way of life is in our nature, so it's no surprise that the most common ethical principles across world civilizations, number one, don't lie, number two, don't steal. It's intuitive. Property rights are also functionally integrated. As I mentioned earlier, the protection of the environment is an incidental advantage of protecting persons and their property. Protecting the environment's automatic. It's already built into the legal system, built into the ethical systems. So creating a centralized coercive agency that attempts to control the welfare of an entire nation or planet's environment creates a host of logistical problems for legal systems, ethical systems, and communication, etc. It's also unethical to presume ownership then over areas or territories of concern. That confounds and questions the whole idea of private property. And then another advantage is that processes and intermediaries are few. Problems can be directly settled between parties and mediated only by the courts. And it's interesting that a lot of major businesses and their terms of use, like Indiegogo or I don't know about Amazon and Google, but if you actually read through the terms of use, which nobody does, they actually require that litigation happens through private arbiters. So I think that's interesting. Guesswork is also minimal. The price of certain properties, the price of pollution, the probable or potential effects on property, because nuisance laws actually only involves real and measurable effects already from the start. And then the guesswork of what the public wants and so forth. That's another issue. Second, it's economically sound. Let's see how quickly I can go through this here. Property rights obeys the laws of economics by default. There's no artificial price setting, like a pollution tax, which, quote unquote, estimates the aggregate cost of pollution on an aggregate population in hopes of balancing supply and demand. There's no way to know if any of those figures are actually accurate because there's not an actual market. If someone wants to spew smoke in my yard or something else or alter the water, they have to pay for it. And that's actually based on how much damage I consider is appropriate. So that's a, there's a theorem called the Coase theorem, Nobel Prize winning economist Ronald Coase said in the words of one economist applying it to the situation, if you're damaged by a polluter and you have the right to clean air, the polluter will either have to compensate you or cease the offending activity. If property rights can be assigned for environmental resources, those resources will likely be used efficiently. Prices reflect real supply and demand. It avoids the tragedy of the commons. You see that. Higher incomes lead to higher demand in environmental goods. Why are some real estate properties worth more? They're cleaner. They have better views. They have more environmental goods. That's already reflected in the price system. Allows for rapid development of technology and innovation. Chemical fingerprinting with pollutants. Some genetic engineering. There are so many new ways in which to control population. That's not possible without a market system already in place to produce those possibilities for innovation and technology. And then, we'll skip that last part. Do I got 2 minutes left? Is that right?
Yeah.
2 minutes. Okay. Buzz through. Number three, it's also ethical. It's fair. It's not biased towards the wealthy or poor. Everyone is equal under the law. Polluters pay for pollution instead of taxpayers. Wow. Property rights are immune to political trends or changing utopian ideals. Right now, it's fashionable to say that a human right is healthcare. Tomorrow, it'll be like, well, it's an essential human right to whatever, own a car or something else. That whole political process isn't even part of law. Immune to crony capitalism. It's much, much easier, or difficult to bribe the courts than to bribe politicians. It has a huge effect on an economy and the environment. And then second, not just being fair, it's also nonviolent. The only coercion that takes place is for those who already have initiated coercion. So if you haven't done anything wrong, then there's not going to be any initiation of force against you or your property. Finally, a fourth, it's effective. And rigorous standards of pollution, that's super, super important. In riparian law, which is an evolution of common rights, common law property rights, any alteration in the water of a stream that comes through your land has to be compensated for somehow. Any measurable effect. That worked really, really well when it came out in the 1850s and 60s in Europe to protect countless rivers. It has a proven track record. There's a number of cases we didn't have time to get into. Proven ally for conservation environmentalists. Private conservation projects have a way higher success rate than public conservation projects. That's really important to point out. The results are inherently mutual and satisfactory. Projects and transactions don't happen otherwise. Because it's based on mutual exchange, it's a mutual thing. Like, there's not a party that's really upset, you know what I mean? Because it won't happen otherwise. It's like going to buy a cheeseburger. Yep, last point right there. Can effectively adapt to changing circumstances. I just already addressed that with the riparian law in streams. So, all right, out of time. Thanks for listening.
Okay, let's thank Jamie.
Well, it depends where you are. You know, the laws are different, you know, especially in the United States. A lot of the laws vary by state to state. You can still make your case for nuisance in a lot of states. I mean, the common law undergirds the U.S., the U.K., and Canada. So there's still remnants there that can be utilized. What can we do? I would, private conservation projects are extremely effective, and I would point out the waste in public projects, because as I show, they basically ignore what economists have been saying for a long time. So, yeah.
You said that it equally affects the wealthy and the poor, but poor people don't own property. You have to be wealthy enough to own property.
Well, it's true. There's a couple ways, points I didn't explain underneath that point. First of all, there's no bribing. There's no crony capitalism. So there's not major corporations, whether it's Monsanto or something else, that are paying off politicians to make laws that are in favor of their business. Okay, so that doesn't happen. Also, it doesn't matter, how whether a poor person has a little bit of property or a lot of property. As far as appearing in the courts is concerned, they have the same rights, right? And if you want to see like that kind of a perversion of those basic principles of justice, there are churches that have been fined for allowing poor people to sleep in their parking lots because they don't have permission. There was a soup kitchen, I forget the where it was, that was shut down. You're no longer able to serve the homeless, to give them what they need on this property because you don't have permission. Like, that's not your job. Which is the greatest irony, like when it becomes illegal to do what the church does, right? So it's like, oh, well, this is the state's job, the church, you know, just do whatever, just go over in the corner, you know what I mean? So I guess those are kind of the two things underneath that point that I meant, but so.
Okay. Other comments?
I think, I really like what you said. One of the greatest dangers I think of this is in places like India, you know, where the common law isn't in effect, I wonder if people who will get their act together in places where the common law is in effect will go to places like India and pollute there.
Well, that's true, is that, I mean, you...
Yes.
It's true that you can't enforce laws that where you don't have jurisdiction. So, and that's true. People will go pollute elsewhere, but that just means we need common law over there. So,
okay, other comments, young man?
I just had a quick question. So you mentioned one of the failures during the Industrial Revolution was that litigation was complicated and expensive.
Sometimes.
I'm wondering, I think it would probably even be more that case now, so they always say the lawyers win, and no matter what. So do you think that we need some sort of reform in the way we handle the judicial?
Well, that's a great point. Yeah, it seems like if you have more money, you have a better chance of winning a court case. That should never be, right? If it's just. Like I mentioned, private businesses are already mitigating that by private arbiters. You know, like Christian colleges, there's a whole Christian arbitration system. And if you do business with us, you do not go through the regular court system. You go through this private arbitration. I think that's a good solution. And I'm hoping technology will smooth things over. You know, like if Amazon or people at Google or, you know, whatever, if they were in charge of resolving conflict, they would probably do a really good job at it. You know what I mean? Like they do. When I get the wrong package in Amazon, A to Z, you know, I file a complaint. There, that's the court system. And it works better than that. So, yeah, I don't know how to reform the courts, though.
Carbon dioxide can be regarded as a pollutant, but yet it's not like one person or institution is spraying it on my property.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm now hotter than I was last year.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that government regulation seems to have some importance versus just individual property rights in cases like that where there's global implications. And thus, mm-hmm. I think the solution to carbon dioxide would involve the price on carbon, which was talked about here as well. The pay the price for the pollution.
There's two ways of doing that, though. Through regulation or carbon tax, or through damages through the courts. And there's a radical difference between the two. The end result is the same. You're internalizing the externalities, the adverse externalities of owning property that emits carbon dioxide. But legally, it's very different because with a carbon tax, the government's saying, we own your property, and we're going to determine, you know, whether this is a violation or not. As where, you know, if you actually own your property, then someone who's emitting carbon that flows over into your air and you're inhaling it, that's a nuisance. So now you say, well, why hasn't common law evolved to the point of dealing with this? Well, it was never allowed to. And there's a number of ways that things like that, air pollution, can be dealt with, like class action lawsuits or through what's called carbon rights. Some people have been talking about that. So this is assuming, of course, that carbon is a pollutant, and it is to an extent. We'll just grant that for now. Like the way carbon rights works is if I emit a certain amount or whatever, I have to compensate for it because it is a violation of other people's property rights. Everybody in the world. Now, I can't sue everybody in the world. Or a person, you know, who's violated, but you can for wherever there's jurisdiction. Now, it would be a tiny, tiny amount, but that's exactly how class action lawsuits work. 3 weeks ago, I got a check in the mail for $7 for a class action lawsuit. I had no idea what it was for. It was for a company that I had business with, and I got $7 because they won. It's the same kind of thing, but it's just different. Yeah.
One more question. Alan, you had a question?
I feel conflicted because I think I agree with about half of what you say. I only disagree with another half. But I think one of the things is regulation hopes to prevent the damage that occurs in the first place that then you have to go to court to get reparation for. I would rather limit the oyster catches in the Chesapeake Bay rather than wait until oysters are virtually extinct and then nobody gets anything but I'm going to make some people pay for something. You have damage that's occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also think of the Old Testament laws regarding what farmers can do. They have to leave part of their fields open. There are instructions that God has done in the Hebrew Bible that indicate a government or God making laws for people to obey that limits their use of their own properties.
Comment,
I should probably wrap it up, but I guess that would have to do, that's more of a theological question. If I was a theonomist, sure. Make generosity mandatory. That's not the perspective I come with. So I'm nonviolent, you know, meaning nothing should be coercive if we can help it. And I think that's actually the distinguishing factor between the New and the Old Covenant.
All right, let's thank Jamie. And I have...